Now, pornography has a long and complicated history in American society. Our next guest interviewed 90 people on all sides of the pornography debate, and she says it's more complicated than pro-porn versus anti-porn. In her new book, she writes that current debates over the place of pornography in our lives echo controversies all the way back to the 1840s when some of the first anti-obscenity laws were passed. She joins us now to share what she learned from that history and from anti-pornography advocates, pro- and anti-porn feminists, porn addiction counselors, and pornography creators and performers. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you view the role of pornography in American society today? What do you think it says about the ways we think about sexuality in the U.S.? Do you think we need to change the way we regulate it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kelsey Burke is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the author most recently of The Pornography Wars, The Past, Present, and Future of America's Obscene Obsession. Kelsey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure.
You go through the history of pornography and obscenity and how we regulate it, and things have changed a lot in some ways, but in a lot of other ways, the debate has remained the same. There's some consistent themes. What has stuck with us over these last 150 plus years?
Yeah, I use the analogy of it's like a long marriage where like the details of the arguments might change, but there's these same underlying tensions that keep rising to the surface. So these revolve around what is the role of religion in American society? How do we find regulations when it comes to sexuality and sexual life? The role of free speech, all have been long sites of dispute, really, as you say, back to the 19th century when it comes to pornography and sexually explicit material.
One of the main things you did with this book, as I mentioned, was interviewing people on various sides, various perspectives on this issue. And I think part of what you're trying to do in this book is to take away from some of the stereotypes we might have of who is anti-porn or who is pro-porn. Can you talk about that a little?
That's right. Well, as a qualitative researcher, I spend a lot of time listening to people's stories. And I think when you do that, this is actually something that Larry Flint, who was the producer of Hustler magazine, wrote about Jerry Falwell, who was an anti-porn crusader. He wrote an eulogy when Falwell died. And he said, you know, something his mother said was, if you spend enough time with people, you'll find something to like about them. And that was actually true of Flint and Falwell. And that was true in my interactions with people across the different sides of the porn debates. And they really disrupted the stereotypes or assumptions that I had about what anti-porn activists would be. So, for example, that they're all religious, that certainly wasn't true. And also broke down stereotypes that I might have had about people who were advocating for reform within the porn industry.
One theme you follow, especially in the modern debate, is over exploitation and harm for people who participate in the pornography industry voluntarily or otherwise. Concern from both ends of the spectrum, but it takes different forms. What kind of arguments did you hear?
That's right. Well, so according to anti-porn feminists who have really mobilized in the 1970s and 80s, there aren't as many prominent groups today, but they've been saying for a long time that porn harms women, period. So there's not a lot of room for caveats in that anti-porn feminist position. There are women in porn today who call themselves feminist and to say that, yes, there are some problems with the porn industry when it comes to abuse or coercion or exploitation, but that's not everyone's experiences within the porn industry. And rather than throw out the porn industry altogether, we need to do things to make it better and safer for the women within it. So that's where there's a real tension between the anti-porn movement, which tends to see all forms of sex work as fundamentally exploitative, and people within what I call the porn positive movement that see a lot more room for women and other people to be able to participate in the porn industry with agency, independence, autonomy, and on their own terms.
You also tackle some absolute statements, some that are opposite of each other. You're just hinting at this in a way. Statements like, you can't be for porn and be a feminist, and you can't be against porn and be a feminist. How is that shaken out?
Yeah, well, I talked to feminists who came down on different sides of that, that for some, you know, the idea is that porn is inherently violent towards women. But for other feminists, they say that that actually takes away women's agency who choose to be in the industry. I talked to many sex workers who really had other choices in their lives. They weren't engaging in what is sometimes talked about as survival sex work, that they don't have other choices. These were women who had advanced degrees, had other career prospects, and they actually chose a career in sex work or pornography because they found that it offered the greatest flexibility, the greatest income in terms of the time that they put in. They were often caregivers of children or other people. And so they said that they could be feminists and still work within the industry.
I want to take a look at a pair of laws passed a while back, the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act and the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, intended to avoid exploitation, but with some unintended consequences along the way. What happened?
Yeah, these are laws that were signed by President Trump in 2018. They're often referred to as SESTA-FOSTA, referring to the acronym. And when they were originally proposed in Congress, they garnered widespread support because who can't get behind the mission that we want to stop sex trafficking? That's something that I think we can all agree is wrong, is harmful, that we need to do everything we can to make it an impossibility in the world. The problem is that this law had some unintended consequences. So for one, it doesn't do a great job of describing or defining what exactly sex trafficking is. It uses sex trafficking synonymously with the word prostitution. And the fear is for sex workers themselves that laws like this actually make sex work more dangerous, because it makes it harder to use the internet to navigate the sexual economy. So sex workers were no longer able to use certain websites that they often used to talk amongst themselves about safe or dangerous dates, for example, that was something that they couldn't do. Internet pornography companies also worried that online porn sites could become the next target of SESTA-FOSTA, even though it seems to only target sex trafficking, that the language is murky enough that any sort of internet content dealing with sex or sexuality could be potentially under fire. So a lot of sex workers I spoke to said that they wished that policymakers would consult them, that they were not consulted in the writing of these laws that directly implicate them and their lives.
We're talking to sociologist Kelsey Burke about her new book, The Pornography Wars, The Past, Present, and Future of America's Obscene Obsession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you draw the line when it comes to defining pornography? What should be allowed or not allowed? Are there things you'd like to see change when it comes to how it's regulated? If so, what and how? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with sociologist Kelsey Burke about her new book, The Pornography Wars, The Past, Present, and Future of America's Obscene Obsession. You can join in with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on pornography and American society. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kat is with us in Eau Claire. Kat, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, thank you so much for this conversation. I think it's super important that we're talking about. I work at an anti-trafficking agency in Wisconsin and in West Central Wisconsin. And so this topic comes up a lot. And I guess my question for you, Kelsey, is just really seeing the effects of pornography playing out and, you know, from a younger age for youth that are really, there's not really a lot of age verification that is in place, it sounds like, at least from my experience, that is preventing kids from finding porn at young ages, and how this is really affecting them in, you know, sexual dysfunction. So, you know, 12-year-olds, young men that are having, you know, physical issues because of it, that is, or directly correlated to it. So I'm wondering, you know, taking the morality out of it, do you see this as a health crisis, or do you, you know, is that something that you would say that you agree with?
Thanks for the call, Kat. Kelsey, go ahead. Yeah.
Great question. So I think that the anti-porn movement has really coalesced into what has been called an anti-sex trafficking movement more broadly. So not only looking at the pornography industry, but other forms of what the movement calls sexual exploitation. The caller mentioned a few things. First of all, talking about pornography as a health concern, that absolutely matches how people within the anti-porn movement talk about porn in the 21st century. So there have been a number of states who have passed resolutions that declare pornography to be a public health crisis and say that it is physically addictive. In 2023, the caller also mentioned age verification. There have been a couple of states, Utah and Texas, that have passed age verification laws requiring pornographic websites to verify that their visitors are over 18. One of the critiques of these laws is that it's unclear how to do this without violating users' privacy. So the state has not given a lot of guidance on how to do this without collecting personal data on website users. There's a group within the porn industry called the Free Speech Coalition that just filed a lawsuit against the state of Utah over its age verification laws. And they advocate instead for a sort of device level restrictions so that kids don't see porn. This is something that across the debate, for those who are porn positive or anti-porn, they agree kids should not be looking at porn. And they also agree that pornography is too often used as sex education in American society and that that's a problem. So that's where I found some somewhat surprising common ground was that we really need to do more in terms of sex education in the United States.
Thanks for the call, Kat. Penny joins us now in Merrill. Penny, hello.
Hi, I guess I'm kind of a follow-up to that first question, and this is addressing, in the past, sexuality was not for children, and I'm seeing that more a change in society, and for instance, the UN is looking at policies that would say there is no lower age limit to where children can give consent to sexual activity, and I'm just wondering, what are the detrimental effects to sexualizing our children in library drag queen shows, in school sexual education programs, in access to pornography, et cetera?
Penny, thanks for the call. I don't know about the UN reference she had there, but she's suggesting, and this is an interesting debate and part of the story, Kelsey. She mentions a drag queen story hour, say, in a library as a sexualizing activity. There will be a lot of disagreement, I think, about whether that constitutes sexualizing kids or not. How does that fit into this wider story?
Yeah, well, I think the point is made that the anti-porn movement is connected to broader conservative efforts, including bans on drag shows and other conservative politics. I think that sexuality has long been a contentious place within political debates. And we do know that in the 21st century, people are being exposed to pornographic content at a younger age than they were, say, in decades past. I think probably the best research out there suggests that children and teens shouldn't be looking at porn, especially as their only form of exposure of sexual information. And this is a problem that is recognized by people across the board. It's difficult to have conversations across, quote unquote, the political aisle when conversations about teenagers and children's access to pornography are being conflated with other conservative issues like drag show bans. So a lot of people would say that these things are not related and that to conflate the two makes it difficult to have conversations across the left and the right or across conservatives or progressives. So all that is to say that I think the polarization that is so often talked about is true also in pornography debates, and that's how it gets connected to broader politics.
Thanks for the call, Penny. We just have a few minutes left, Kelsey, and I want to get into concerns about the way the parts of the porn industry treat women, obviously, and women of color in particular. You talk about that some in the book and efforts to, I guess, make better porn in a way.
Yeah, that's right. So commercial mainstream porn has long been criticized for basically relying on sexism and racism for pornographic films. And so a lot of really negative, damaging, violent stereotypes. At the same time, workers within that industry have always exhibited what, as a sociologist, I might call agency. So ability to find spaces of autonomy and choice, though the amount of power they have has always reflected broader social inequality. I'll just bring up one example from a historian who I quote in the book, Murray Miller Young. She talks about the porn industry in the past. And so, for example, back in the 1930s, she writes about how Black women in sex work almost certainly faced racism and likely abuse and harassment. But that was also true for Black women working in other industry sectors. So domestic labor, one of the only reputable work options for many Black women, where sexual assault and rape was almost guaranteed. So Miller Young cautions us to assume that sex work is somehow worse for Black women than other industries, since racism and sexism are present in all social institutions. So this is something that I heard from a lot of women within the industry, that this is a problem of sexual harassment that is not unique to porn, and really needs to be reckoned with in broader society.
Kelsey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Kelsey Burke, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. She talked to us about her new book. It's called The Pornography Wars, The Past, Present, and Future of America's Obscene Obsession.